Hi, I'm Kate Wells. I'm your host of Art Pod. Welcome back. Welcome to 2015. We're going to kick off the year with an interview with Britt Bennett. You may have read her piece last month. It's called I Don't Know What to Do with Good White People, and it's fascinating. It went crazy. I mean, I think there's been more than a million views, 53,000 likes on Facebook, thousands of comments. What it is a piece that looks at what it's like to be black in a white liberal progressive community like Ann Arbor, which is the community that Britt Bennett lives in a place where people think that, you know, their intentions are good and they therefore are not racist. And it's a little bit about what Bennett's experience has been like there. It's a fascinating piece. So we're just going to get right into it. We kicked off the interview. I asked Britt to read a little bit of her piece here so you can get a sense of what the essay is like.
Okay. I don't know what to do with good white people. I've been surrounded by good white people my whole life. Good white people living in my neighborhood who returned our dog when he got loose. Good white teachers in elementary school who pushed books into my hands. Good white professors at Stanford, a Bay Area bastion of good whiteness, who recommended me to MFA programs where I met good white writers, liberal enough for a Portlandia sketch. I should be grateful for this. Who in generations of my family has ever been surrounded by so many good white people? My mother was born to sharecroppers in Louisiana. She used to measure her feet with a piece of string because they could not try on shoes in the store. She tells me of a white policeman who humiliated her mother by forcing her to empty her purse on the store counter just so he could watch her few coins spiral out.
Britt, one of the things I wanted to ask in general was what kind of a response you've been seeing to this. I mean, this piece went bananas. It just got picked up everywhere. It's been, you know, commended all over the place by some just really great writers and great thinkers. And there's also been a ton of discussion that's come from it. Tell me a little bit about the kind of response you've been seeing and your reaction to it.
Right. Well, I think I'm just really overwhelmed and completely shocked, to be honest. I wrote the piece. I thought it was something that, you know, maybe a few of my friends would share on Facebook. I didn't expect the people to be sharing it on Twitter or how many views it's received. So I've mostly received a pretty overwhelmingly warm response, which shocked me a little bit. I thought, at least to my face, I thought that I might receive sort of more criticism, but a lot of people have said that the piece challenged them. They said that it made them uncomfortable, but sort of in a good way. And a lot of other people told me that I was able to sort of speak to some of the things that they had been feeling or thinking in the wake of Ferguson and all the stuff that's going on in the country right now. So the response has been completely overwhelming, but pretty positive overall.
So many of the responses, especially on Jezebel, were from white people or people who say they're white people and recognized themselves in this piece, felt really uncomfortable, and then kind of like almost wanted to ask you a question of what should I do? How
right.
do I be a good white person, which is kind of unfair to like ask you to like suddenly
right.
wish like that you're like the pope of good white people and
right.
that you can bless this. But a lot of the comments really said like, you know, I'm going to read one here that says, yeah, I think that we as white people have to step away from the idea that racism is something intentional and conscious uh-huh. and deliberately cruel. It's so much more than that. We're all racist in that we've internalized some of these ideas. But at the same time, I'm really angry and I want to be active and I want to have
right.
some kind of part in sharing that. And I feel like not taking part is almost as bad. So how do I go about doing this? When
right.
you see these people suddenly asking like, how do I be a good white person? What do you think? Are you just baffled? Do you have suggestions?
Well, I think, first of all, I did receive a few tweets or even some messages on my Tumblr that were speaking to that effect from really sweet and really nice people who were just asking, well, what should we be doing? And I want to just first say, you know, like you were speaking to, I don't have all the answers. I really think of this essay as me sort of trying to piece through my own thoughts about it. I think of this essay even more of a question than sort of arriving at some real answer or solution. So I just want to preface my answer with that. But I think that I've just been thinking a lot about what it means to be an ally. And I think one of the things about that is that allies to me are people who go into places where the group that they are an ally for cannot necessarily go. So I think that one of the ways to sort of be a good ally without this sort of good white person that I'm kind of speaking to in that essay is, are people who are able to go into places that I don't have access to, using your privilege to sort of help the group that I belong to, the group that anyone else belongs to. So to me, that's, you know, people who are able to march, that's great. But also people who are able to, you know, shout down people in their family who are being racist, or who are able to go into other spaces that I don't have access to. So I guess as far as how can people sort of avoid being this good white person, to me, that person I'm sort of criticizing, I guess I would say, are people who feel the need to sort of applaud themselves for what they're doing. I don't want people to be sort of paralyzed where they feel like they can't have these conversations. And that's sort of a response I got from one of my white friends who I sent this essay to. Actually, the first person I sent it to was sort of like, well, what should we do? I feel like silence, there's sort of been this meme about silence is violence, so people don't want to not say anything. But I guess to me, it's sort of, where is it coming from? Are you sort of using your privilege in a way that is helpful to somebody's group, or are you just sort of using your voice to try to make yourself seem better?
One of the things, and you mentioned specifically the criming while white
right.
thing. There's right. also that same feeling of, like, you know, what you put on your Tumblr, that picture of, like, you know, different protests of white people. Please don't be the one who gets the loudspeaker. Like,
right.
let's let the other, like, this is not your cross to bear necessarily.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the criming while white hashtag was interesting to me because I think, you know, it's sort of been criticized as something that kind of speaks around black people to other white people. And in that respect, I don't think that there's a problem with it. I don't think that it's something that's meant for me because I already know the things that this hashtag is saying. I know that privilege exists. I know that I don't have certain types of privilege. So I think as far as it is an educational tool for other white people who may not realize that some of these things are a privilege. Like, for example, you know, I live in Michigan. It's very cold in Michigan. But I never walk into stores with my hands in my pockets just because I know that if I do, people might think that I'm trying to steal something. And that's like a small thing, but that's something that I'm aware of that other people may not be aware of. They might not even, you know, think about that. That's sort of what a privilege by definition is. So I think that as far as it's an educational tool for other white folks, I think that it's great. But I also think that I agreed with some of this other criticism that was on Jezebel about the way in which it does sort of co-opt the conversation a bit in a way that's not completely helpful. So I guess I don't want to come across as someone who's sort of, you know, stridently against any efforts of white people to sort of contribute to this conversation or advance it. I think that this is all really important. I think... I know, like, my white friends talk to me about race. I want them to talk to their other white friends about race because I think that's in ways as important, if not more important, than talking to me. So I don't want to come across as sort of shouting down any of these efforts. But I do see some problems with them that I've been sort of thinking about, and that's what kind of led to this essay.
Going back to the essay, can I ask you to read one more section? It's the
sure.
section... that actually it's just one paragraph. It's my mother tells stories of Klansmen writing at night.
Okay, let me find it. Okay. My mother tells stories of Klansmen writing at night, of how her grandmother worried when the doctor's son, a white boy, visited her youngest sister because she feared the Klan would burn down their home. When I was a child, I only saw the Klan in made-for-TV civil rights movies or on theatrical episodes of Jerry Springer. My parents knew what we would later learn, that in the 90s, in our California home, surrounded by good white people, we had more to fear than racism that announces itself.
Tell me what you mean there.
Well, I guess I was thinking about this sort of anecdote because I think that the KKK is such this sort of enduring symbol of racism in America. And for very real reasons that I was sort of speaking to about generations of my family living in very real terror of this very sort of blatant symbol of racism. But I think about the ways in which even, you know, my parents, you know, just one generation back, the ways in which they grew up and how different that is from the way I grew up, not living in this type of terror, this type of fear of that type of blatant racism. I think I feel very fortunate, I want to say, I feel very fortunate for coming of age in a time and a place when I did not have those types of experiences I'm very different from any other generation of my family. On my mother's side, I'm, you know, one of the first generations that's even actually literate. So I feel very grateful for the progress that our country has made, that my family has made, to be in the position where I'm in. But I also have been thinking about the ways in which racism sort of manifests itself a lot differently from my generation. It's a lot less blatant. It's a lot less in your face. And because of that, we're forced to sort of think about race in a very different way. And I wanted to speak to that a little bit with just sort of analyzing these very, you know, these little anecdotes that I talk about, like this anecdote at the airport with this woman who cut me, or these other different things and the ways in which we're sort of forced to turn over interactions and think about whether they are motivated by racism. Because nobody wants to be a racist nowadays. Nobody wants to be called a racist. And I don't want to call anybody a racist. But because race sort of manifests itself in these more subtle ways, it becomes this sort of really deep psychological analysis when I'm interacting with somebody and I don't know if the way that they're treating me is bad because I'm black or if it's just because of some other effect. And I think that that's something that's very unique to our generation, having to parse through these really detailed interactions in a way that, you know, with my mother experienced in the Jim Crow South, she never had to do that type of analysis. She knew what people thought of her. So I guess that's sort of what I was thinking about when I think about this, you know, my sister being afraid by learning about the KKK and how, you know, my father sort of laughs it off.
You know, and that was something that in the comments on this piece and some of the follow-up was mentioned a lot. There was a comment here that maybe you saw. It's from a woman who identifies herself as black and says she's married to a white man with a white family. And just a quick quote that she has, she says, "I realize that good white people," which of course she capitalizes the three words. "I realize that good white people don't think they're racist, but so many of them are, and I am exhausted. I'm tired of holding back my words. I'm tired of being a passport into blackness. I'm tired of being safe Negro friend. I'm tired of being a living textbook. I'm just tired."
Right.
And in your piece there, that's a huge part of what comes across of, like, this is exhausting.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think it's sort of the mental and the emotional work it takes really is exhausting. I think about this Toni Morrison quote I like, where she says that the nature of racism is that it's distraction. Like, racism distracts you from your work, and it distracts you from your life. So I definitely feel that exhaustion that commenter is talking about. And I think also one of my friends sort of said that being black, particularly in white spaces, constantly causes you to question your lived reality. And I think that's something else that has also stuck with me. You know, I don't think anybody sort of thinks of their lives as being solely governed by race. But nobody's life is completely untouched by race either. We're all living somewhere in this sort of murky in-between. And I think that sort of causes us to have to do a lot of sort of mental and emotional work that's draining, frankly. And I think that was sort of one of my biggest feelings, I think, this past, you know, month with the non-indictment in Ferguson, the non-indictment in New York, and this sort of influx of unarmed young black men who have been killed by police officers. It's just this feeling of exhaustion. And I think, you know, my mother said to me one day, like, "I just really didn't think we would still be dealing with this now." And that type of feeling of just weariness, I think a lot of people share that feeling as well.
You know, and not to, like, sound too public radio here, but there's all this, you know, studies and science and things that they can suddenly categorize about what trauma and you know, poverty and all those kinds of things do to kids and in sort of like super extreme situations. And suddenly we're able to suddenly understand this, and you know, you can see it pop up in different learning and blah blah blah. But this piece also made me wonder, like, I wonder if one day we'll be able to have some kind of, maybe not a measurement, but maybe just a better way to recognize what this kind of exhaustion does to somebody. Not to turn you into a victim, but to suddenly just say, like, this is a real phenomenon.
Right. And I think, you know, people point to, you know, health studies that show, you know, on average, you know, black people live way shorter than white people. And for a variety of socioeconomic factors, I'm not saying racism is the sole cause of that. But I do think that it makes you wonder, like, the toll it takes just on you, sort of mentally and emotionally and physically, to have to navigate in a world where you have to sort of make these tiny calculations and you have to sort of consider the intentions of others constantly, because it's a survival tactic. It's not particularly because anybody wants to do that, but it's just sort of a nature of having to sort of navigate in a world like this.
I have one last question for you, Brett, and then obviously I'll open this up to you because this is a massive conversation that we could have for hours. But one of the things that also came up in the comments was a lot of white people kind of saying, you're right, I probably have some things that I've internalized that I'm not comfortable with. And that's something that's been part of a discussion post-Ferguson, post-Eric Garner, that everybody, especially white people, seem to be having, which is, I have internalized these ideas, and I keep thinking of these moments that I have in Detroit or in parking lots late at night, and it's, I would be lying if I say that I've never felt that, like, horrible, weird twinge of, like, fear / guilt when I feel vulnerable and I see somebody and I think this person is menacing or they're scary, and then I immediately think, oh my God, what a horrible person I am, scared because of a person's skin and their clothing. My question is, do you have moments like this?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's something that is, that's super complicated. And I do know the feeling that you're sort of speaking about. And I think that it's, you know, I think that that's something that, yeah, I mean, I guess the thing for me sort of when I hear that is thinking about just the ways in which we're constantly sort of fed these images about who is scary and sort of who should be feared. And I think a lot of us do have sort of subconscious responses. And, you know, even this whole thing about police shootings, I mean, this is not to say that, you know, and I guess this is part of my sort of issue with intention because, okay, well, what happens when a black cop shoots an unarmed black man? Is that something that's not racist because he's black? You know, to me, I would say no to that. I think that the idea that black men are sort of perceived uniquely as being threatening or something to be feared, I think that's something that black people can also internalize, like myself included in some ways. And I think also being a woman, you know, moving through the world, there are certain fears that come with that and certain other considerations that I'm making about my safety. And there are ways in which sort of all of these ideas about fear and race and gender and all of these things can become sort of mixed up. So I guess that's why I'm sort of pushed against this idea of intentions in my essay, because, you know, there are black people who are victims of police brutality that's conducted by elder black people. And I don't think that that's something that should be considered okay, because in his heart, he may not have intended, you know, he may not be hateful against black people in his heart, blah, blah, blah. I think that's why sort of actions matter more in some ways. So, yeah, I don't know if that was clear.
No, it is. And it's basically that line that you had about what good are your good intentions if they kill us?
Right. Right. And I think that's what one of the problems is, focusing on intentions or focusing on racism as sort of intentional hatred in your heart. You know, we get seduced by that. It's sort of the idea of, you know, Donald Sterling, for an example, when those voicemails came out and he said these horribly racist things about the Clippers, people were very angry and they were very up in arms, because that was the sort of racism that we expect. Here is a person who is being very blatant about how he feels about black people, and that's the kind of thing that we expect. And everyone sort of piled on him. But for years, this guy had been sued for these very predatory and very racist housing practices. And in many ways, that type of racism is a lot more harmful. But because it's not as sort of blatant, it's this type of slow violence, nobody is paying as much attention to that as they are when he just outright says these racist things. And I think that's one of the problems, is that we really do get sort of drawn in by this racism that seems very blatant in our face, and we don't pay attention to these other things that have sometimes even more harmful effects.
It's because they're so much more difficult to handle. I mean, it's really easy to fire Donald Sterling and be like, well, you know, that's terrible, but it's much more difficult to take on an entire system of where you don't.
And I think exactly. And I think nobody really, you know, black or white, nobody wants to think that we live in a world where there are all these systems that operate outside of our control and that oppress us for factors that we can't actually control or affect. Like, that whole sort of way of dealing with the system becomes very overwhelming, so it's easy to sort of latch on to the, you know, inflammatory statement or the comment or this indicates that this person might have felt whatever. But I guess I wanted in this essay to sort of push back against that because for two reasons. For one, because as you sort of said, there are people who do mean well in their hearts but who still act in these ways that are harmful. And the other reason is that there are people who are doing these things that are harmful, and we get sort of seduced by the sort of blatant thing of what they mean or what they feel or what they believe. So I guess I wanted to push back on it in sort of both respects and I guess sort of challenge people to maybe question themselves or think a little bit deeper about how we're all positioned in these sort of systems, how we all interpret race and how we all experience it.
Britt, I am so appreciative that you took all of this time this morning to talk with us about this. This is just really, I'm so glad we got to have this time with you.
Thank you so much. I'm glad you guys found the article interesting.
Yeah, to say the least. Britt, I like to do this just kind of at the end of interviews. It's just like, is there anything, it feels so silly and weird with this conversation, but I usually say like, is there anything we didn't get to talk about that you wanted to or any questions you wish I asked? But I feel like I'm like, is there anything about racism and systemic endemic racism that we didn't say in this 25 minutes we had together? But seriously, is there anything else you wanted to talk about?
I guess I would just thank everybody who read the essay and who responded to it. I didn't get a chance to sort of dive into all the Jezebel comments, but a lot of people have been tweeting me and have been very warm and thoughtful with their responses, even if we might disagree on certain points, so I've greatly appreciated that. And I'm glad that we're able to sort of continually have this conversation and the ways all of us are sort of flawed, the ways we're all sort of striving to be better in the ways that we all can continue to strive to be better.
All right, that's it for today. Again, major thanks to Britt Bennett for taking some time to talk with us. Thanks to you for listening. And if you've got any suggestions about things that you want to hear, see, read on ArtPod, go ahead, send us an email or leave us a comment. I'm Kate Wells, and thanks again for listening.
Support for arts and cultural reporting on Michigan Radio comes in part from a grant from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs and the National Endowment for the Arts.